Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and all of it is brought to you by the good folks at Upside.com. Go to Upside.com, use the code MARTINI, and start your Upside six-star treatment right now. And we'll talk more about what that means a little bit later in the podcast. And Jim, let's start with the good martini. It's not often that liberal researchers come up with answers that we feel like we've known a long time. But honest intellectual activity is always appreciated, especially when it validates the conservative position. But we have been arguing for a long time that the facts do exactly that. Leah Labresco is this researcher's name. She has been affiliated with Nate Silver and the 538 site for a while, and she started looking at gun policies as well as the impact suggested gun policies would have on the number of homicides in this country. She looked at 33,000 different homicides. She probably had some help with this, but here's the crux of her conclusion. I researched the strictly tightened gun laws in Britain and Australia and concluded that they didn't prove much about what America's policy should be. Neither nation experienced drops in mass shootings or other gun-related crime that could be attributed to their buybacks and bans. Mass shootings were too rare in Australia for their absence after the buyback program to be clear evidence of progress. And in both Australia and Britain, the gun restrictions had an ambiguous effect on other gun-related crimes or death. When I looked at the other often praised policies, I found out that no gun owner walks into the store to buy an assault weapon. It's an invented classification that includes any semi-automatic that has two or more features, such as a bayonet mount, a rocket-propelled grenade launcher mount, a folding stock, or a pistol grip. But guns are modular, and any hobbyist can easily add these features at home, just as if they were snapping together Legos. As my coworkers and I kept looking at the data, it seemed less and less clear that one broad gun control restriction could make a big difference. Two-thirds of gun deaths in the United States every year are suicides. Almost no proposed restriction would make it meaningfully harder for people with guns on hand to use them. I couldn't even answer my most desperate question. If I had a friend who had guns in his home and a history of suicide attempts, was there anything I could do that would help? So, Jim, we hear often about assault weapons bans and universal background checks, and we talked yesterday about a lot of other proposed policies that aren't quite as simple as their proponents would have us believe. But to have this deep of a dive into the research and prove that there's no easy solution here, it's on one level gratifying, but it's also maddening on another.
Well, look, my hope is you see more pieces like this. And I want to really give credit to Leah Labresco. This probably was not an easy piece to write. Nobody likes admitting, I got this wrong, or my initial beliefs were not correct, or my initial conclusions were not correct. And it does say something about the value of really digging into the numbers and digging into the facts and trying to let that guide your thinking instead of having a particular viewpoint and then trying to, you know, adjust the data or adjust what you see in the world. And succumbing to confirmation bias. And there's two aspects of this. The first is, when she says, you know, the idea that a lot of these proposals are only popular because they irritate gun owners, that's hitting the left where they live because they like to think, no, we simply want to save lives. We're not in the business of needless political antagonism and demonizing people who are different from us. It is very important that we tend to have these gun control debates after a mass shooting. And many of us accurately point out that most of the gun control legislation and ideas that are discussed after that really wouldn't do any good after a mass shooting like this. We keep hearing, you know, apparently this morning Nancy Pelosi was saying it's time for universal background checks. Once again, the Las Vegas shooter passed his background checks, right? Like, the people keep saying, oh, if we just did the background checks better, then we wouldn't be in this situation. But the vast majority of mass shooters purchased their guns legally. What this researcher did is she pointed out that if you really look at the amount of gun crimes and murders in this country, they really stem from things that are not mass shootings, things that do not make national news and call for national conversations and get to be the subject of late night comics, teary monologues to start the show. They were very often gang related. There are very often suicides. And the third category, if you talk about, is people who are very often women who are victimized by domestic abuse, basically. Their partner is violent and the violence escalates and they use a gun to, you know, women are murdered in that case. And she put the category about 1,700 women murdered last year, usually a result of domestic violence. Now, if you tailor your legislative or legal responses to these categories, the idea of mentoring programs for young African-American men in inner cities who are at victim, who are at risk of becoming a member of a gang, then you will probably, if you put more resources into this and you put more focus on this, then you have a better chance of reducing these young black men being the victim of a gun crime or getting murdered. If you have a stricter enforcement and, you know, if you take domestic abuse seriously, and if you restrict or disarm someone who is convicted of this, well, then by golly, you're probably going to have fewer women getting murdered by this. If you enhance the amount of resources available for suicide counseling and hotlines and various programs like that, you're probably going to have fewer people killing themselves with guns. When this came out yesterday afternoon, Greg, there was somebody who had a very sharp observation. They said, look at what happens when you stop looking at the problem as a problem of guns and you start seeing the problem as a problem of people. Look, I think most gun owners would be perfectly fine with these proposals. I think you'd probably get a bipartisan, you know, majority support for these kinds of ideas. And I think we'd be a much better country if we focused on ideas like this. And you know, dealing with the mindset that causes someone to pick up a gun with the intent to harm themselves or the intent to harm someone else, instead of simply saying, oh, we got to ban silencers because, you know, wouldn't Las Vegas have been worse if they had silencers and stuff like that?
Yes, exactly. And I encourage folks to read The Morning Jolt today because Jim does an excellent job of talking about the warning signs in a myriad of these cases. Obviously, you know, warning signs could be reported and maybe that person isn't on that path. But to have it more closely examined and not just dismissed because a specific crime hasn't been committed, but a closer evaluation of that person's state might be helpful in a lot of these different ways. So let's move on now, Jim, to our bad martini. And Jim, when I read this story, I just think back to 2006, which was not a good year for conservatives or Republicans, and it just seemed to unravel in a number of ways. We had Duke Cunningham and Bob Ney with their financial dealings. Towards Election Day 2006, there was the whole disgusting Mark Foley situation, and it was just kind of a perfect storm, especially when you threw in Iraq and Katrina for the Republicans that year. And this is a story that CNN quoted someone as saying, this is why people hate politics. And I have to agree. This is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. A text message sent in January to U.S. Pennsylvania Congressman Tim Murphy by a woman with whom he had an extramarital relationship took him to task for an anti-abortion statement posted on Facebook from his office's public account. Quote, and you have zero issue posting your pro-life stance all over the place when you had no issue asking me to abort our unborn child just last week when we thought that was one of the options. Shannon Edwards, a forensic psychologist in Pittsburgh with whom the congressman admitted last month to having a relationship, she wrote that on January 25th. A text from Mr. Murphy's cell phone number that day. In response says, I get what you say about my March for Life messages. I've never written them. Staff does them. I read them and winced. I told staff, don't write anymore. I will. The congressman has been lauded by the Family Research Council for his stance on abortion, as well as for family values generally. Turns out she wasn't actually pregnant, so no abortion actually took place. But, Jim, people hate hypocrisy. We talked about it yesterday when it came to deficits on the right. Now you've got a pro-life congressman who's only too happy to accept the awards. But when something unexpected and unwanted happens in his own life, the knee-jerk response seemed to be in that direction based on what we know. Just absolutely Greg, despicable.
You forgot one of my favorite examples from 2006. Yes. Don Sherwood, Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, 10th District, who had been married. He'd been having an affair with a Peruvian immigrant who was more than three decades younger than he was. And apparently in 2004, he had struck her, attempted to strangle her. She locked herself in a bathroom. Sherwood told police he was merely giving her a back rub. The term attempted to strangle his mistress is really bad in any reelection campaign. But we should emphasize, it's not that attempting to strangle his wife is that much better. Strangling people is bad, but attempting to strangle his mistress, it's like a twofer, right? It's, you know, what we're seeing here with this guy Murphy, it's another Pennsylvania lawmaker, huh?
He is Pennsylvanian. He's a Republican. He's from the lower left-hand corner, the southwest corner of the state.
If you're a pro-choice Republican, campaign as a pro-choice Republican, don't say you're pro-life because you want the votes of pro-life Republicans and you know, voters for whom that is a priority, but deep down personally not believe it, because my suspicion is it will come out at some point. Usually not in such a dramatic form like this, but the second thing is just like, God, what a creep! What a top to bottom creep! By the way, he hasn't resigned yet, has he?
No.
What would it take? What would it take? Right? I mean, the sooner Murphy departs Congress, the better. And like I said, there's this eerie, creepy echo of the Sherwood case. And look, you know, we've all kind of seen the cliched stereotype of, you know, congressmen chasing the secretaries around the desk and stuff like that. The affair is bad enough. That reaction to a pregnancy. And then when called out upon the hypocrisy of being a pro-life, public pro-lifer, and then saying, well, clearly we can, you know, abortion is an option, not only an option for the pregnancy, but that he thinks it's a, he was recommending it, to get called out on and say, ah, oh, then blame the staff. Like, I mean, this just kind of just layers creepiness and irresponsibility on one case on top of another, on top of another. So the sooner Murphy departs Congress, the better.
Yeah, two quick items to close on this. First of all, he won the seat in 2002. He has won it easily ever since. The last two times, he didn't even have a Democratic opponent. So if he departs the scene, it's not like he's uniquely qualified to hold this seat for the Republicans. Kick him to the curb. You deserve better. You can clearly do better in this district, and you won't probably be in any danger of losing the seat to the Democrats. Secondly, you know what his job was, Jim, before he went to Congress? A psychiatrist. So he might need one more than actually want to go back to
himself.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's talk about some good options rather than the bad options that Congressman Murphy was talking about with his mistress. If you travel for business, you know it's a game of wins and losses. Popping open an overhead bin and finding it empty? Win! Sleeping through a wake-up call? No, not so good. Buying your business trip at Upside.com? Well, that's not just a win, it's a triple win, and for a lot of reasons. Number one, Upside has the absolute best available prices for flights, hotels, and rental cars.
Win number two is that Upside will reward you with a gift card to places like Amazon.com every time you buy a business trip. And number three is the amazing six-star treatment that you'll get from Upside's customer service specialist, who they call navigators. One recent Upside customer was called away for an emergency meeting and had to miss his wife's birthday. So a navigator sent her flowers to try to help ease the disappointment. And that's pretty nice, right? That's just one example of how Upside navigators go above and beyond for business travelers. Now just imagine what they can do for you.
Upside navigators are instantly accessible 24/7 by voice, chat, email, or message on the Upside app, even reaching out to you with useful info to help you avoid a problem even before it happens. And now we're going to start your Upside six-star treatment right now. Go to Upside.com and use our code MARTINI, and you'll get a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com. That's code MARTINI for a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com when you buy your next business trip at Upside.com. Upside.com, you deserve a better business trip. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. Again, Upside.com, code MARTINI. Jim, let's move on now to our crazy martini. And, you know, as you head into a midterm election, you're trying to rally everyone who would be likely to support you in 2018. You want the whole team on the field. You want everybody engaged and out there and voting for your nominees. Well, maybe that's not exactly what some people in this administration want. To Politico we go. Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff railed against congressional leaders in closed-door remarks to wealthy donors and called for a purge if GOP lawmakers don't quickly rally behind President Donald Trump's agenda. He was speaking at an RNC event in Washington Tuesday morning. He said Republicans are on track to get shellacked next year if lawmakers don't get on board and pass Trump's priorities. But Ayers reserved his harshest criticism for congressional leaders and members who have not offered full-throated support for the president. Quote, just imagine the possibilities of what can happen if our entire party unifies behind him. If, and this sounds crass, we can purge the handful of people who continue to work to defeat him, Ayers said, according to an audio recording of the remarks obtained by Politico. One attendee later asked how the donors could rally the congressional delegation that does support the president and vice president and rally them and push them to change the current leadership in both the House and Senate. Quote again from Ayers, I'm not speaking on behalf of the president or vice president when I say this, but if I were you, I would not only stop donating, I would form a coalition of all the other major donors and just say two things. we're definitely not giving to you, number one. And number two, if you don't have this done by December 31st, we're going out, we're recruiting opponents, we're maxing out to their campaigns, and we're funding super PACs to defeat all of you. Jim, obviously primaries will play out next year, and you can get behind whoever you want. We like to point out a handful of people in the Senate who have derailed the Obamacare repeal that you know the names well, Collins, McCain, Murkowski, and a handful of others. I'm not sure that blowing up everybody who's ever had a bad thing to say about the president and vice president is the best way to make sure you have majorities in 2019.
You know, with the exception of the attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare in the Senate, keep in mind, it passed the House. Paul Ryan got his guys behind it. By and large, the problems of this administration are not ones of Republicans turning against the Trump agenda. And in fact, I'm looking at the numbers here on 538. It's not surprising that Susan Collins is the Republican senator who has voted in the way the Trump administration wanted least often out of all the Republicans in the Senate. What may surprise you is that she's voted with the Trump position 79.6% of the time. Right? So it's not, so about 20%, she's voting, you know, against the administration. McCain, the percentage is 83%. Murkowski, 85%. Rand Paul, 87%. So by and large, in the Senate, you're getting the kind of cooperation. That doesn't strike me as a wild, unreasonable amount of deviation and things like that. You look over in the House, you know, you have 435 members. You're going to have, you expect to have somewhat, most of them are voting, you know, 90% of the time with the president, high 80% of the time with the president. Justin Amash of Michigan, he votes with the president 66% of the time. Always kind of been that way. Walter Jones, North Carolina, votes with the president 61%. But most of these guys, it's three-quarter, you know, Mark Sanford of South Carolina, 78%. Again, most Republicans are voting with the president. You might say, okay, there's lots of, you know, renaming post office bills and stuff like that in there. I don't really think the problem of this administration is insufficient Republican loyalty. You could argue one problem is insufficient number of Republicans, particularly when it comes to the close Senate votes. I think it's, you know, we can look at the tax debate going on right now. Clearly, the vast majority of Republicans support tax cuts. And the most, you know, like that's kind of why Republicans exist. When you get to the issue of should we repeal the deduction for state and local taxes, it's really not surprising that Republican lawmakers from New York, New Jersey, California, maybe Michigan, maybe Minnesota, and a couple other, you know, kind of bluish states, all of a sudden they wouldn't like that idea. All of a sudden, wait a second, you're taking away a big chunk of the tax cut for the people who live in my state. And you know, I think it's fair to say, whatever you think of that proposal, it's not like Republicans were campaigning on that in 2016. This was not part of the Republican platform. It's not like Trump was stopping in New York and New Jersey and California and saying, oh, by the way, you guys aren't going to get nearly as big a chunk of the tax cut that I want to enact as everybody else. All right. So really, you know, deep down, what is the problem for congressional Republicans in the Trump administration? Well, they can't all agree on what they stand for. And if the president, you know, my suspicion is the president doesn't really like the idea of repealing state and local taxes. He doesn't talk about tax policy in this level of detail. He, you know, mostly talks about how great it's going to be and how big it's going to be. But you don't see him get into the running the numbers terribly often. I think this is a matter of scapegoating. Is it, you know, really annoying that McCain and Rand Paul and Murkowski and Collins killed off any chance of Obamacare repeal and replacement? Yes, and they deserve all the flack they're getting about it. But by and large, when this administration can't get its policies enacted, Greg, you think it might have anything to do with the fact that we still have an empty chair at the Department of Homeland Security? We have an acting secretary there. Tom Price just departed. There was a report, you know, when Rex Tillerson had his press conference today, quite a few folks expected it was his resignation. He said he'd never thought about resigning, but very few people think he'll be around, you know, a year from now. This is an administration where the cabinet is kind of on pins and needles and kind of terrified of being the subject of angry Trump tweets. They turn into the scapegoat of the month. This is an administration where, look, the president's attention is easily distracted by, you know, by whatever he sees on Fox and Friends or Morning Joe that morning. It's gotten a little better with John Kelly in as chief of staff, but by and large, this is an administration that creates its own problems, and that the amount of loyalty they're getting from members of Congress on the Republican side is pretty darn reasonable, even really good, considering the political environment they're in.
Yeah, Jim, when you're listing those percentages on how often they vote with the administration, I was thinking, well, some of those might be like deputy assistant secretary of some department. I'm like, oh, wait, there aren't nominees for those positions yet.
Yeah, confirmation votes are there. But you know what? Most of them, there aren't Republicans who are objecting to the Trump cabinet. The one case you could point to is the Obamacare bill, repealing and replacing that. Beyond that, the Democrats, Republicans have pretty much lined up in order. If there's anything that might be really frustrating this administration is we had this perception that Trump was going to be the Trump administration because of his populist nationalist, because his appeal not necessarily aligning with that of a traditional Republican, that he was going to make a lot of Democrats feel kind of nervous in the South, Midwest, to the extent they still exist, and that Ohio, Pennsylvania, there were a bunch of Democrats who are going to find themselves feeling nervous about crossing the president. I don't think that has been the case through the first 8 months of this administration.
Obamacare is clearly the big one. We'll see what happens with tax reform. Some folks aren't happy that they're still kicking the can down the road on spending. They wanted the wall to be underway at this point. So there are some issues out there. They want results. And we're going to have primaries in some of these key Senate races next year, clearly Arizona and Nevada. And I'm sure there will be a pretty raucous open primary there in Tennessee now that Bob Corker's not running. The key that always comes to mind for me, Jim, unless the nominee is egregiously awful in some way, when they hand you the ballot in the primary, at least in Virginia, they say, by doing this, you're promising to vote for the nominee come November. Have all the food fight you want in the primary. Just make sure that you don't give the Democrats control of the Senate, because if you think nothing gets done now, wait till Chuck Schumer runs the Senate, if in fact that were to happen. Hopefully it won't, given the numbers in the Republicans' favor on the map in 2018. But while you get mad at the incumbents, and sometimes that's definitely warranted, make sure you don't get so mad that the Democrats end up being the winner here.
Just an observation of, the other thing is that it's a sneaking suspicion that there's some pieces of legislation that are being kept on the shelf for 2018. Greg, it's pretty obvious the House and the Senate have the votes to enact concealed carry reciprocity. Basically, if you have a concealed carry permit in one state, you'd be free to use it in another state, and there wouldn't be a chance of, New York State arresting you because they don't recognize a Connecticut concealed carry permit. That'd be popular. Quite a few people would be pleased by that. They haven't done it yet. Maybe that's on Congress. Maybe that's on the Trump administration. Maybe they just kind of forgot about it. Or, one of the more cynical theories I've heard floating around is that they want to do it right in time for the signing at next year's NRA convention.
Well.
But, Republicans, you can do other stuff besides these big pieces of legislation that people will actually feel and expect. And maybe if they pass tax cuts by December, all this will go away.
Well, it could. I can imagine if the reciprocity bill comes up and some of these red state senators on the Democratic side who are up next year, like Manchin and Heitkamp, can't you just picture them like rounding the corners and just blitzing through people to get to the floor so they can vote this and make it look like they're
Stand in their way, Chuck. Look out, Nancy.
Craziness, badness, and some goodness out there. Jim, amazing day as always. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please, folks, don't forget to go visit Upside.com. Use the code Martini and get that $100 gift card to Amazon.com. Upside.com, that's your source for booking flights, hotels, and rental cars. Join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.